From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A deadly shooting carried out on live TV. Two journalists killed while doing an interview on camera left the country and the newsroom of Roanoke's WDBJ news station shocked.
We're all in a state of shock here. You can hear people behind us in the newsroom crying. I mean, it's just really hard to...
We're holding it back, too.
Yeah, it's really hard to even comprehend.
Donald Trump throws Jorge Ramos of Univision out of a press conference when Ramos asked a question out of turn about immigration.
No, you don't. You haven't been called. Go back to Univision.
A roller coaster of a week for Wall Street. After markets took a dive earlier in the week, they bounced back. Here's Wall Street trader Art Cashin on how the market will recover.
You will see markets trading around up and down for several days. These things are rarely resolved on a single day.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with James Pindle, Brian Monroe, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story this week? How are you processing the live TV shooting? Are you breathing a sigh of relief that the markets rebounded? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Boston is James Pindle. He's political reporter for the Boston Globe. He writes the Ground Game newsletter. James Pindle, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington is Brian Monroe, contributor to The Root, former CNN politics and opinion editor, now professor at the School of Media and Communications at Temple University. Brian Monroe, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me. Always great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us as always. Hello, Jack.
Hello, James and Brian.
Well, let's start with the week of wild gyrations in the markets. Chinese stocks suffered their worst single-day percentage loss in more than 8 years. That sent the Dow tumbling to an 18-month closing low. As we go to air, both the Dow and the S&P have recouped their losses. Brian Monroe, what about the shockwaves this week in the global markets?
It is showing, again, how the global economy is both affects the U.S. markets and in some cases doesn't. You know, we saw that the initial scare that we had a few days ago where the market dropped 1,000 points in the first few minutes came back and recovered pretty decently. Then the next day it dropped and came back a little bit. Overall, the week it's down. But as the Chinese are trying to, I guess, manipulate their currency to deal with their own problems, that is, you know, reverberating around the planet. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, particularly those of us who have 401ks and other investments, you just sit still and be quiet and let this wave pass.
Certainly a mixed picture in global stocks, Jack, but the U.S. saw a sharp increase in economic growth and the number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits fell more than expected last week, pointing to a steadily improving labor market, at least.
Indeed, over 3% growth in the period leading, the second quarter? We don't know yet about the summer. Very encouraging. And, of course, right now the Fed is contemplating whether to pull away the punch bowl from what looks like at least the beginnings of a party here. We don't know whether they will. That is, whether they will raise interest rates at the end of September. Or whether the Chinese turbulence, the uncertainty in the markets, whether that will cause the Fed to hold off until December. But certainly it's a very cloudy picture one way or another. You know, this week the Wall Street Journal surveyed economists, 56 of them. 62 of them, actually, about what they feared for the economy. And the main fear they had was that there may be some sort of shutdown of the government coming up and that could really hurt the economy. Some Republicans have threatened to, you know, stop the government over the refunding of Planned Parenthood. There have been Senator McConnell says that won't happen, but that there are fears that the debt ceiling could once again be held hostage, and these economists of 55 of the 62 are worried about that as a bump in the road.
Well, Jack, thank you. Of course, the other big story this week we'll move on to now is the shooting of the television crew during a live broadcast in Virginia. James Pindle, what struck you this week about this horrible story, people shot dead on live television?
Yeah, this has been a pretty weird week for journalism, period. But obviously, this happened live on television. And the first discussion in journalism circles is whether or not to air this footage live to show any kind of footage. And news organizations, if first I believe CNN said, you know what, we'll have some caution. We'll only air it once per hour, as if that was caution. And then you had a number of news organizations pushing back and saying, no, we're not going to air this at all. This is going to obviously sparks once again a conversation about just how many gun deaths there have been in the United States. Clearly, when it comes to mental health issues, it could be a gun, it could be a knife, it could be anything, but there have been a number of gun murders in the United States, particularly in this last year, to bring it to attention. So, and we saw the father of Allison, the reporter who was shot, talking about how he wants to make gun control his issue and part of his legacy to his own daughter. But again, I'm not sure what happens next, right? We've seen this time and time again. Congress is on recess. I doubt we're going to see any change to gun control laws. We may have some increased funding for mental health in Virginia, though there have already been a number of things in Virginia. Obviously, the Virginia Tech shooting, the attack from a state senator, Cree Deeds, in Virginia from his own son that has called for increased mental health resources, and particularly with hospitals there. So I'm not sure what's going to be different in the aftermath, but clearly it drove a lot of the emotional core of this week.
Well, we now know that the gunman bought two handguns legally last month, used one, of course, in the shooting. He passed a background check. Here he is. You made reference to him, James. Andy Parker, the father of Allison Parker, who died, of course, this week. In a CNN interview yesterday, he vowed to join the fight for gun control. He questioned how many more attacks like the one on his daughter will Americans have to endure before gun restrictions are put into place.
How many new towns are we going to have? How many Sandy Hooks? How many people, how many Allisons are going is this going to happen to before we stop it?
Brian Monroe, these disclosures about these handguns, when they were bought, how they were purchased, certainly renewing calls for some action by some on gun control in this country. What do you see next?
Well, you're seeing the politicians do the dance right now about do they touch it, do they not touch it. In fact, you've seen Hillary Clinton come out and fairly forcefully reiterate her concerns about gun violence and the proliferation of handguns, and more importantly, the lack of waiting times and background checks. But the other thing about the story that's fascinating is the media aspect. And you look at how this story played out first on the air. Most of us probably found out about this through an alert on your smartphone or on your screen before you turned on TV. Then on Twitter. And, you saw the gunman who posted, was live tweeting this on Twitter and then posted his video. It looked like a GoPro, first person view on Facebook. And that led to a lot of discussion about do they air that or not. And then you saw the New York Daily News that used frame grabs from that very video on their cover with the headline executed on live TV. Mm. And, as journalists, the story, very much hits home, but the coverage of it, it pushed sensitivities.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the social media aspect of this story?
Well, it's that's our world, isn't it? I mean, things just get out there, they get disseminated, and then even news organizations that might have a twinge of conscience say, well, we have to show what's happening out there. We're not reprinting it. We're just showing what social media is doing. It gives them an out. I'm just struck with the uphill battle that Mr. Parker has right in his own state. Terry McAuliffe, the governor there, who had an F rating from the NRA, still was elected governor. He had introduced various gun control measures. One would have limited the handgun purchases to one a month. That those went down last year. And here's what you're up against in gun control. He had to veto two bills that would have one would have made it easier for Virginians to purchase machine guns, and another would have allowed residents to carry loaded rifles or shotguns in their vehicles. Now think of that. That's legislation reached his desk in Virginia, making it easier to buy machine guns.
And again, Jane, this is James. If you want to step back and analyze where this debate goes based on this particular event, as you mentioned, he passed the background checks.
Right.
So there's a call for more background checks. He passed them. And if the other approach, maybe from the NRA, is to say that, if more people had guns, we would prevent this violence. I'm not sure how that's possible in this particular situation. He walks up, doesn't even say a word, and starts shooting. I don't know how you defend yourself very quickly based off of that.
Let's get
James,
a call.
I was going to just jump
go
in.
Go ahead, Brian.
As a reporter and as a photographer, and I've done both, and actually worked down in Roanoke, the Roanoke Times, there's no way you know, particularly working journalists can nor should be packing weapons. It gets in the way of this, the story. It really is dangerous as you're out there reporting, and it's just not what journalism should be.
Let's get a caller in here on this. Rick is in Austin, Texas. Hi, Rick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I have been struck by the story at a number of levels. I was a former broadcast journalist, and as I've been seeing the story evolve online and through my Facebook friends and former journalists, I think I've been feeling, and those of us who have been watching the story, is this collective pain, a collective sigh, a collective sadness that it could have been any of us. And the story keeps evolving more and more as we learn about the disturbing events. In fact, today I read the New York Times report that this Flanagan applied to a station at which I worked at one time. Mm-hmm. And so as a small group of professionals, I think we all are looking at this thinking it could have been us. And when we see our colleagues fall like that, it becomes so personal. And disturbing at the same time, I personally have chosen not to watch that GoPro video. I mean, mm-hmm. I watched lots of gruesome things in television news for as long as I worked in it.
Mm-hmm. But even Rick, I know a lot of people feel the same way you do. James Pindle, I'll come back to you before we go to the break here. You mentioned Hillary Clinton. How is this incident generally playing on the campaign trail?
Very predictably. I mean, clearly everyone's having a moment of sorrow, but and they're just, you know, doubling down on if they're for gun control or they're not. But the one thing that has been talking about more and more is mental health on both sides.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this week about what happened in the news. You can join the conversation. What's your headline from the campaign trail this week? Hillary Clinton taking responsibility for the emails. Trump taking on Univision. Joe Biden? James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, is with us. Also, Brian Monroe, professor of journalism at Temple University. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. A lot of listeners want to get in on this point of gun control. Let's go to Richard in Liverpool, New York. Hi, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
My 11-year-old son once said a long time ago, "Dad, it's been bad since Cain disabled Abel." And I thought about that frequently. People, you know, injuring or hurting other people. And it seems like an inescapable part of human nature. So the question is, for all rational folks, is if you were being victimized by some bad people, and someone came to your aid with a legally armed citizen coming to your aid as a good Samaritan, would you refuse the help of that good Samaritan on a philosophical basis? Would you say, "Oh, please, I disagree with the right to protect yourself," and then go ahead and get hurt?
And where is the rational middle ground? I know a lot of people feel that way and otherwise. Richard, thank you. Let's go to Alma in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Alma. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, please.
I've been thinking about this issue for a very long time. I'm 70 years old, and it seems lately that people don't get the message that something is a problem until they see it on a video, whether it's the Ferguson, Missouri, or the shooting on TV. I think the only way we're going to get the message about the ugliness of guns is to show the killings on TV a lot. Mm. And finally, people will see that it's, because in our heads it doesn't seem that bad until we see the pictures. And as ugly as it was, I think if we had shown the Newtown pictures, people might finally get the message we have to do something about the prevalence of guns in this country.
Mm. All right, Alma, thank you. We will devote an hour on Monday to gun control here at On Point, so you can listen for that. We're going to move on now to the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. This week marks that anniversary, and President Obama spoke in New Orleans on Thursday about it. He referred to the government's responsibility in somehow failing New Orleans.
An American city dark and underwater. And this was something that was supposed to never happened here, maybe someplace else, but not here, not in America. And we came to realize that what started out as a natural disaster became a man-made disaster, a failure of government to look out for its own citizens.
Brian Monroe, you were down in Biloxi, Mississippi when Katrina hit. You, of course, led the team of journalists from the Sun-Herald, won the Pulitzer Prize Gold Medal for service in 2006 for your coverage of the hurricane. Tell us your reflections 10 years later.
You know, it's fascinating looking back, and it almost doesn't seem that it was 10 years ago. I remember landing. We actually flew into Atlanta. I had a team of journalists with me and rented a vehicle. We came down the freeway past, I think it was Birmingham, and ended up in Biloxi the day the storm hit. We were coming down as the storm was coming up. And I remember getting out of the vehicle, and the editor of the Sun Herald, a big, burly ex-Marine named Stan Tyner, who's about to retire, gives me this big bear hug and says, the Marines have landed. And for the next 2 weeks, on the ground, covering the most amazing story I think I've ever covered in my life, it really, first of all, reminded me the importance of journalism and you know, bringing those stories to real people in those communities. And also perspective. I was there in Biloxi and Gulfport and Pascagoula in South Mississippi. And as bad as the damage was in New Orleans, most of that damage would not have happened, as we know, had the levees not broken. But the brunt of the storm hit South Mississippi and really destroyed it. And I was back there about a year ago, and a lot of it's been rebuilt, but a lot of it will never be rebuilt. Mm.
Well, as a senator running for president, Barack Obama promised to overhaul the city's, a lot of things in New Orleans, the city's healthcare infrastructure. He said he would rebuild schools, provide local kids with better education, vowed to rebuild the local economy. Brian, how does the reality stack up against the promises?
Well, I think it depends. If you look at the initial reaction after the storm, in many ways, the state of Louisiana and certainly the city of New Orleans was paralyzed. They did not have their act together. They were bickering. They were pointing fingers. In contrast with the political cooperation that happened in Mississippi, South Mississippi, where a lot of the construction money came in early, there was, of course, the big issues around insurance companies that would not pay off claims. You know, they would say that, okay, there was storm damage that ripped your roof off, but then the rain came, so that's water damage, and you're not covered. And so a lot of changes had to happen in how insurance companies were handled. So, you know, I think, unfortunately, it's still a work in progress.
James Pindle, 10 years later, what do you see?
I'm struck by when this moment happened, the political reality became Democrats wanted to talk about competence. They wanted to talk about the Iraq War. They particularly wanted to talk about Katrina. And then we had a much more, you know, hope and change election. Then we got so sort of very, very ideological. And now we're starting to talk more about populism on the trail and less about the competence of governments doing their job. And clearly, President Obama has tried to put an emphasis in his presidency on making FEMA work. It's one of the things he thinks is part of his legacy. It's one of the things you can control basically without a lot of congressional oversight. But as we look back on that period in Katrina and then we compare it to where we are today, it just seems so wildly different, even though most people have not really forgotten much about New Orleans. Mm.
President Obama's message down in New Orleans. Jack Beatty, what did you hear?
Well, the Times yesterday did a scorecard on the Obama and Bush administrations. We forget. I mean, President Bush got bad marks, and certainly his FEMA director did, for their immediate handling of the crisis. But thereafter, he committed federal funds on a large scale, and President Obama followed that up, I think, $74 billion in various reclamation, flood, all sorts of levee building, the whole work. And so there was some continuity there, and it seems to have affected things. What I read is it's a tale of two cities, as so many American cities are. On the one hand, New Orleans is attracting new people with new ideas and in new industries, high tech. On the other hand, inequality vis-a-vis white and black has grown, and even the good news, schools are doing better. Schools are now all charter schools. But at a cost, the cost of the layoff of 7,000 mostly African-American unionized teachers. I mean, that's just a blow to the local economy. So it's a complicated picture. But I do think over two administrations, there has been an effort to rebuild New Orleans.
Tale of two cities. Brian Monroe, is that how you see it now?
In many ways, both in New Orleans and in South Mississippi. You know, you look at New Orleans and, you know, the crime issue is still prevalent. It's not as strong as it was 10 years ago. They've done a really good influx and changed how they handle low-income housing and the issues going around with low-income housing. But you still see a lot of the same infrastructure problems. And at the time when the economy is changing so dramatically, and the same thing with South Mississippi. You've got a tourism-based industry where they used to have, remember those casinos that were on barges?
Mm.
They're no longer there. They're now land-based casinos. I remember one barge I stood next to it that was on the water. It was lifted up by the storm and pushed like 50 feet inland and dropped back on the middle of the street. This is a giant barge the size of a city block. So those are gone. So, you know, you've seen some changes and a lot of growth, but you've also seen a lot of flight from the region, particularly in New Orleans. There are not as many African Americans in New Orleans now as there were 10 years ago.
Here's Blaine in Abilene, Texas, on this point. Blaine, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, my family and I, we're actually, we lived in New Orleans when Katrina happened. We evacuated the day before the storm rolled in. And, we haven't moved back. I mean, we kind of started a new life here in Abilene once we realized there wasn't going to be much to go back to in our case. And just to comment on kind of the change, I think as some of the people were calling up, as New Orleans changed. And yeah, it has changed a lot in my view. I mean, it has, like, in many different ways, but the soul of New Orleans is still there. The soul of it is still alive and well. Mm. From what I can see.
Blaine, thank you so much. I appreciate that call. Good luck to you and your family. Let's move on now to presidential politics. So much to get to this week. Where to begin here? Let's start with the confrontation between Univision reporter Jorge Ramos and GOP presidential candidate and frontrunner in many polls, Donald Trump, during a news conference. James Pindle, recount for us what happened and why.
Yeah, so, you know, Donald Trump, before he does these big rallies, he has a long press conference, about 30 or 40 minutes. This is unlike any other candidate you cover. Particularly, they have them after the event. But this is better and easier for TV crews to get their package done. And, you know, at the beginning of this, Jorge Ramos, he's a well-known anchor at Univision, stands up, is not called upon by Trump to, you know, go ahead and ask a question. And then he begins, let's be honest, give as much of a speech as he did a question about Trump's immigration plan. And they got into a back and forth. Eventually, Trump tells him to sit down. Then he tells him to go back to Univision. And then he does cue one of the members of his security team who ushers Mr. Ramos out of the room. And then now it's clear that we're going to be talking about this as the story. The next question from a journalist was, why did you kick him out? Trump says he didn't even know who he was, which is clearly not true because he mentions he's from Univision and knew who he was. And then they invite him back into the room. And then they get into a really interesting 5-minute back and forth on this particular issue of immigration, exactly how Donald Trump's plan that he unveiled 2 weeks ago would work logistically. And then it became sort of a media storm where, frankly, Jorge Ramos used it to benefit his own celebrity, and Donald Trump used it to benefit the idea that he's railing against the media.
Here he is, Jorge Ramos, being kicked out, of course, of the press conference. He appeared on the Fox News program The Kelly File, spoke with host Megyn Kelly, someone who's had her own problems with Donald Trump. Here's that.
Can you understand Trump's side of it, which is, this is not the outlet I want to take these questions from because their mind is made up about me.
I understand that, but also he's talking about the fastest growing electoral bloc in the United States. He's talking about 16 million Latinos that will go to the polls and might decide the next election. So it doesn't matter if he doesn't like it. There are questions that need to be answered. And the problem is that he's not used to being questioned. He doesn't like uncomfortable questions.
Jack Beatty, Donald Trump hasn't been saying much to appeal to Latino voters lately, to say the least. But making Jorge Ramos, who's referred to as sort of the Walter Cronkite of Latin America, leave the press conference certainly doesn't help improve that image.
No, he's upside down, favorable, unfavorable, minus 51. among Hispanic Americans and probably sinking very fast. You know, that news conference, as the Times noted in a news story, really brought out something else. Viewers, the Times write, saw something more revealing, the profound vulnerability and insatiable hunger for affirmation that lurk beneath Trump's better-known qualities of bombast and bravado. This is when he tried, first of all, a reporter complained, you've sent Ramos out, bring him back. Oh, okay, I'll please you. Then Ramos came in and he tried to get Ramos to agree with him. And at the end, he said, you know, you're right. You know, Hispanics love me. You love me. He was back on that again. You know, when you look at that, you wonder, is this the personality that should be president of the United States? Is this the kind of character? And I think we all owe a service to Mark Salter this week. He's a former chief of staff of John McCain. Has no reason to like Trump, for sure. He wrote a piece called "Trump's a Narcissist: What's His Supporters' Excuse?" And what he did was he went to the Mayo Clinic website and wrote down this about narcissistic personality disorder. Copied it down. If you have narcissistic personality disorder, you may come across as conceited, boastful, or pretentious. At the same time, you have trouble handling anything that may be perceived as criticism. You may have secret feelings of insecurity, humiliation. To feel better, you may react with rage or contempt and try to belittle the other person to make yourself appear superior. That does sound like somebody. And this week in a focus group in, I believe, Virginia, Fox News basically found people saying, we like his confidence. We like his confidence. But what Salter is pointing out there in this look at narcissistic personalities, the confidence high, you know, is a mask for this deeper insecurity. And in that respect, Trump is exhibit A, it seems to me, for this kind of personality.
Well, from Trump on immigration to Trump on taxes, when asked about his policy on taxes during an interview this week with Bloomberg, Donald Trump gave new insight into who he believes should receive the brunt of taxation.
You're proposing that you'd like to raise taxes on yourself instance.
That's right. I'm okay with it.
Okay.
Ready, willing. You see my statements. I mean, I do very well. I don't mind paying some tax. The middle class is getting clobbered in this country. You know, the middle class built this country, not the hedge fund guys. But I know people in hedge funds, they pay almost nothing. And it's ridiculous, okay?
James Pendle, there he is, saying he'd be fine raising taxes on himself, raising taxes on the wealthy. What do you make of this week, that statement? Not typical from a GOP candidate, certainly.
It's not. And we haven't really heard much reaction from other GOP candidates on this particular plan. You know, for all the criticism that Donald Trump got on his immigration plan, that it's unrealistic. For example, you can't just call the 14th Amendment unconstitutional, or your plan is to somehow get rid of that amendment, or logistically, how are you going to get rid of remittances that go back to people in home countries? Does that mean you're going to go to FedEx and make sure you see what's in every single box going back home? You know, his plan, which he has not exactly released yet on taxes, is actually quite serious, and it is a real proposal. You know, he's talking about raising taxes on the rich. He wants to lower taxes on the middle class. He's feeding to that anxiety that we're at in this moment in this country, part of it fueling his campaign. But then he goes further. He wants to, you know, lower the corporate tax rate. He gets pretty detailed on exactly what he wants to do on a number of issues when it comes to taxes, which could eventually be his wheelhouse. Look, we talk about the summer of Trump, and a lot of that was fueled by this anger over immigration. We are going to move into an electability component, a more serious component. I think taxes is where Donald Trump's headed next.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, 10 years since Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans resident Angela Chalk told NPR that there was never a question to stay in New Orleans in the 7th Ward after the devastating storm.
Yes, we are Creole, and yes, we are hard heads, and yes, we will remain here because this is where we choose to be.
The top French honor awarded to the three Americans and one Brit who stopped an attacker aboard a high-speed train headed to France. Here's one of the Americans, 23-year-old college student Anthony Sadler, on the attack.
We just all ran back there, and we tried to, like, do whatever we could to beat him up, like, just so he didn't shoot anybody.
And this week marks 40 years since American rock icon Bruce Springsteen came out with his big breakout album, Born to Run. That long. You can join the conversation. What are you thinking this week on the Iran nuclear deal, Tropical Storm Erica, and the migrant crisis in Europe? James Pindle is with us, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Brian Monroe, professor of journalism at Temple University and contributor to The Root. And Jack Beattie, as always, On Point news analyst. Here's Jeb Bush speaking to reporters on Monday, defending himself over a statement he made to a conservative talk show about, quote, anchor babies.
What I was talking about was the specific case of fraud being committed where there's organized efforts, and frankly, it's more related to Asian people coming into our country, having children, in that organized efforts, taking advantage of a noble concept, which is birthright citizenship.
Brian Monroe, Jeb Bush getting into hot water with Asian Americans, trying to clarify his earlier remarks about anchor babies. He's dropping a bit in the polls. How are you looking at the Bush campaign right now?
You know, he went from the frying pan to the fire again. You know, it's fascinating to watch, you know, particularly this latest round around anchor babies. Donald Trump was the one that put it out there to begin with. And seeing how Jeb Bush feels like he has to go even farther to the right to engage that conversation, something he probably would have never talked about 5 years ago. It wasn't his style, but he feels like he has to go there because, you know, he's got to get some attention. He's got to break through with all the oxygen being sucked out of the room by Trump in his position. But, you know, it really highlights a larger problem that Republicans have, and that is they cannot seem to get past their I guess tone deafness when it comes to communities of color, and particularly Hispanics and Asians and somewhat African Americans. We saw that with Trump and the Jorge Ramos situation. Again, Bush and the Asian comments. He'd been better off just leaving it alone and moving on.
James Pindle, how do you see this?
You know, this is an issue that's in his wheelhouse. He wrote a book about this just a couple of years ago. We're not talking about, say, the wildfires out west in California and elsewhere. We're talking about the issue in his wheelhouse. And he knows very well about the issue of anchor babies. He knows that the concept, by the way, is not accurate. It's not like if you have a kid here, you can automatically become a citizen yourself. But what's been fascinating, this overall narrative this week, is Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, you know, both really coming out as fighters. They're different candidates this week than they were in the last couple of weeks. They both feel a little bit on the ropes. But as we end the week, I would feel a lot better if I am Jeb Bush, because I think most people accept the premise that this is slowly becoming a campaign about two different people this fall. It's going to be about Donald Trump and about Jeb Bush. And as much as that dynamic is happening, it's not about other candidates. And I think that if you're Jeb Bush, you say, look, he has at least $120 million that in the super PAC that lets him spend money on other states going forward. No other candidate has anything close except for, I guess, Donald Trump's personal wealth. And second, that he believes that the campaign will get more serious and he's the serious candidate. I mean, we are ending the week that way.
And yet, he's facing such a headwind. The New York Times really put it out. For all his paper qualifications, Mr. Bush has been angering to many, boring to many others, inspiring to none. I mean, it turns out
that about Hillary Clinton or is that about Jeb Bush?
You know, it turns out, perhaps this could be for both of them. You know, it turns out that William Butler Yeats called the GOP race. He said, the best lack all conviction. That's you, Jeb Bush, while the worst are full of passion. passionate intensity.
Let me bring Hillary into this because she had quite a change of tone this week. Hillary Clinton here telling a group of reporters that while her use of one email account was legal, it was not her best decision.
My use of personal email was allowed by the State Department. It clearly wasn't the best choice. I should have used two emails, one personal, one for work, and I take responsibility for that decision.
James, this was quite a turnabout for Hillary Clinton, right? Now taking responsibility for this email story that's been dogging her for weeks.
Yeah, there's no indication that internally they have changed, that they still believe that this is a media firestorm, that voters don't care. And that's not true. Voters do care when you talk to them. You know, voters may not tell me to my face that I need to lose, you know, 15 pounds. But, I mean, they may not tell her that, you know, she has some email issues. But people are worried about it. But this was an extremely critical week for Hillary Clinton. In fact, even if she wins the presidency and all the topsy and turvy of the next year and a half, this could go down as a top five week for Hillary Clinton. Not only because she changed the tone, but she, again, is under pressure. And so you saw a more fighter mentality. You saw her yesterday, by the way, comparing Republican presidential candidates and their positions on women with terrorists. And this is talking about, like, I guess, ISIL that, you know, has slavery. That was a pretty extreme statement to be making. So she's doubling down on demographics, on women. She's doubling down on that she's going to be a fighter. And then you saw her release a number of memos in early states last night showing her with a really strong organization. And then this morning she comes out saying that she's going to have a number of 440 superdelegates who can vote for her, and that means in the national convention, which means she's already a fifth of the way to the nomination. So what she's really trying to do is show that she's got an organization, she's going to fight. And hey, Joe Biden, have you noticed how many delegates I have right now?
Right. Well, speaking of Joe Biden, here he is in a phone call with members of the Democratic National Committee this week. The vice president saying that he is assessing whether he has the, quote, emotional fuel to run for the White House.
If I were to announce to run, I have to be able to commit to all of you that I would be able to give it my whole heart and my whole soul. And right now, both are pretty well banged up, and we're trying to figure out that issue.
Brian Monroe, in a national poll, Quinnipiac University, I think, showed that Joe Biden performed a little better, actually, than Hillary Clinton against leading GOP candidates in a general election. How would Joe Biden candidacy shake up this race?
Well, it all depends on which Joe Biden we get. If we get the Joe Biden that ran before that was energetic and passionate, if not a little clumsy, it could be interesting. As he said in that clip, he has been hurt certainly by the passing of his son Beau. But you know, and it's interesting to watch how the White House is handling this, because you know, he has by all accounts been an extremely loyal vice president to President Obama, and it's not just for show. It's actually very real there. Everyone I talked to around that, part of the reason why we're talking about him is because how Hillary has been floundering lately, even with her good week. You know, that there's a sense of vulnerability, a sense of a window of opportunity that he could step into, because, you know, she can't shake the email story. She can't shake, you know, other things that have continued to have even her supporters question, okay, is she all that honest? Is she really being up and up? You know, you had Benghazi before, and even going way, way, way back to Whitewater. She can't shake these things. And that's a political vulnerability that I think, if nothing else, a Joe Biden entering the race could make this race much, much more interesting. And even some of her own people say that.
Jack Beatty, what do you think is going through Joe Biden's mind right now?
Well, here's what he's thinking. If the Republicans win in 2016, everything Barack and I did over 8 years zeroed out. Executive orders on power plants, immigration, maybe even the one banning torture, zeroed out. Financial reform, Obamacare, zeroed out. The climate change agreement with China, nuke deal with Iran, zeroed out. Never before has an out party promised to zero out the whole record of the in party. Can I sit back and let that happen? Bernie, he can't win. Hillary, she's playing to lose. I can hear Mom saying, Joey, dust yourself off and go out and fight. I can hear Beau Run, Dad, run. I can hear my friends. The country wants Biden values, not Clinton values. Sure, I'm old. I'm tired. I'm grieving. I'm still game. And I have a reason to run to prevent the elections of 2008 and 12 from being annulled.
This is James. Can we just put this moment in context, though? I mean, remember, Joe Biden is not leading in any of these states. No one's really begging for him to get in. In fact, when they poll Democrats, it's 50-50 of whether or not he should actually give this a shot. So this is not 1991, and we're all waiting for Mario Cuomo, who's both the liberal dream and the most electable Democrat, to get into this race. Joe Biden's not Mario Cuomo. He's your college safety school, where if your number one choice does not work out, he'll be just fine.
Well, I got to move on here. Our time is short. Let me move on to Planned Parenthood, because this week Planned Parenthood gave Congress a report that says a forensic analysis of sting videos taken by anti-abortion activists have been deceptively edited. Congress is, of course, investigating allegations that Planned Parenthood illegally profits from fetal tissue donation. Here's Vice President of Planned Parenthood, Don LeJuin, saying that videos show no evidence that anyone is breaking law and that something else is driving anti-abortion activism.
It is completely about their agenda to take away safe legal abortion in this country, to destroy reproductive health care for women in this country, and to destroy Planned Parenthood that stands up and fights for those things.
James Spindle, what about the discrepancies in these videos?
Yeah, again, the details obviously matter in terms of driving the news coverage, in terms of driving what we think is going to happen. But look, this is a debate that's going to continue to rage on ideologically on both sides. What really matters here is whether or not there can be enough momentum or enough political incentive in the system, which I think there is, to have a serious conversation about if we're going to shut down the government over this. I mean, one thing that's going to change is we're going to stop talking so much about Donald Trump, believe it or not, and the conversation is going to shift back into Washington. The Pope's coming to the country next month, and we're going to see this possible shutdown of the government over this particular issue. Abortion's about to become front and center in American politics.
Let's get Jonathan in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My comment is simply around the fact that, yes, the videos might have been edited or changed in some way, but the issue has not changed, and that is Planned Parenthood, with tax-funded money, selling fetal or baby body parts, however you want to look at it. You know, most people, I don't know anybody that doesn't want less abortions. It's either an evil on one side or a necessary evil on the other side. But should we really be paying or giving money to an organization that is selling baby body parts? I mean, that's what it comes down to, regardless of what was done with videos and regardless of if that's legal or not. Should it be? Should it be? And that's the question. And I think people are uncomfortable because it's just in their face right now. And that question is in all of our face.
Jonathan, thank you. Jack Beatty, to Jonathan, you say what?
Well, that's a very fair-minded framing of it. I just don't see any evidence that they're selling it. Selling implies a profit motive. And from what I've read, the money that changes hands when Planned Parenthood sends these, let's call them body parts, which is what they are, to laboratories, is the mailing cost, the shipping cost. It's like being reimbursed. Now, maybe they shouldn't be reimbursed that $30, that $100, whatever it is, and they should absorb that through their own means. And perhaps that would be a way of removing all that that really troubling aura of body parts for cash. But, you know, this week, Jeb Bush made a comment. He said, look, why are we giving them this money? They don't do anything for women's health. And then I was watching this on television, and then a pie chart came out, and I think it showed something like 85% or I don't know whatever it was of the budget of Planned Parenthood goes for women's health. For things that aren't abortion. Abortion is a slice of it, but it's not more than 10%. And, you know, it's just clear that women all over the country for decades have used this institution, and that it performs a very valuable role in the whole realm of women's health care. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, thanks so much for the call. In our remaining minutes here, I want to move to the migrant crisis that's facing Europe. The worst crisis since World War II, in fact. The bodies of more than 70 migrants were found abandoned on a highway in Austria this week. Here's the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees spokeswoman, Melissa Fleming.
These are people, mostly refugees, who have fled trauma, have fled war, and are dying on the highways of Central Europe. There's something fundamentally wrong with this.
Mm. James Pindle, European leaders really have not been able to find consensus on how to deal with this.
And they haven't really been able to find consensus except for domestic politics on what to do about immigration, period, for the last two decades, right? This has been a, we talk about this playing out in the United States. We're talking about real issues when it comes to Europe. These people coming from Syria, they're coming from Africa. I think we saw another report of something along those lines this week as well. Just horrifying images.
Mm. Brian Monroe, unscrupulous smugglers now within Europe's borders, not just out at sea.
Yeah, who knew that there was a Bulgarian-Hungarian smuggling ring? I didn't. But, you know, as we get close to the story, I was actually in Europe about a month ago in Berlin and Prague. And, you know, most of us don't realize now how porous those borders are. There's no, because of the EU, there are no border checkpoints when you go from one country to another in most cases around that region. It's just, you're just, it's like you're driving from Ohio to Indiana. And so with 3,000 or so trucks that pass through those checkpoints every day, it's impossible to know what's inside of them, much less crack down like they need to.
Jack Beatty, this is the biggest wave of migrants really since World War II. Final thoughts here.
Salute to Angela Merkel. She said yesterday she defended Islam as a religion, quote, that belongs to Germany. Germany accepting over 800,000 asylum seekers this year.
Well, thank you very much. A terrific panel, insightful hour here. James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. James, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Monroe, professor of journalism at Temple University and contributor to The Root. Brian, great to speak with you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Always great to have you, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.